KZSU Stanford. The views or opinions expressed by the host, DJ, or their guests present on KZSU 90.1 FM Stanford do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Leland Stanford Junior University or its associates. We thank you for tuning in to this KZSU 90.1 FM broadcast. And now another edition of Shedding Light. Welcome to another edition of Shedding Light. I'm Bird, your host, and today honored to have back on the air here, Director of Peninsula Peace and Justice here in Palo Alto, Mr. Paul George. Paul, welcome back to KZSU.
Pleasure as always, Bird. Thanks for the invite.
Sure, and I kind of, there was an ulterior motive on my part, too. You're, second, third, fourth, fifth time, you got Amy Goodman coming in to speak tomorrow night.
Yeah, it was just 6 months ago that she was last here.
Yeah, back in April.
But she's got a new book out in paperback called Breaking the Sound Barrier.
Yeah, it's a collection of all her op-eds, right?
A number of them, yeah. Various essays and things.
And she's speaking tomorrow night. What time?
Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock at First Presbyterian Church. That's at 1140 Cowper Street in Palo Alto, just a couple blocks off of Embarcadero, so it's easy enough to get to.
And people can go right on peaceandjustice.org and see all the details, right?
That's right. And they can also order tickets. You can order tickets online up until about noon tomorrow, so you don't have to stand in line. We do expect a big crowd.
Cool.
But she's in the Bay Area. She's speaking for KPFA tonight up in Berkeley, and then she'll be down here tomorrow night. So that's Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Tomorrow night, the 17th at 7 p.m. First Presbyterian Church. It's great to have her back.
Mm-hmm. Been a couple of months since you've been here. A lot of things have happened, gone on. Kick it off, Paul. What do you got?
I think one of the critical things this week that's going to be really important is when Barack Obama gets back from his Asia trip, he is expected to announce his new strategy, whatever it might be, for Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And, there was some encouraging news last week when he apparently rejected all four options that had been handed to him, that he wants something that has an exit strategy, which is a good idea since we've been there for 8 years already. It's America's longest war at this point, I believe.
Hmm.
That would be expected, the announcement, maybe, by Thursday, the 19th or so. And as we know, General McChrystal, who's in charge of the whole Afghanistan operation, has asked for anywhere from 40,000 to 85,000 more troops. And, we're still in the middle of this financial meltdown, a heavy recession. Congress is battling over the cost of health care reform. And for every 1,000 troops that are deployed to Afghanistan, it costs this country $1 billion a year for every 1,000 troops.
Repeat that again, because I don't think people know that.
It's $1 million per soldier. So every 1,000 troops that are sent to Afghanistan, it's $1 billion a year to send them there, keep them there, supply them, the whole bit.
Now, since we're broke, that's not our money. Where are we getting the money to do that?
Well, you know, Obama was just in China, and I think he's probably borrowing more from the Chinese.
Oh.
You know, the amount of U.S. debt that China holds is incredible. But yeah, we're borrowing it.
Does
we're
that make
borrowing
you nervous?
Against the future.
Does that make you nervous when you hear that our politicians have basically sold us to China to the point where if China wanted to do something that was against our better interest, our politicians might have to go along with it and just tell us, hey, dude, swallow it, because they own us.
Well, they do, but they also, you know, have kind of tied themselves to us as well. These two economies, the U.S. and Chinese economy, are really kind of tied together now in this new global economy.
And, mm-hmm.
You know, we're not going anywhere without the Chinese and vice versa. I doubt very much that China would ever use, you know, the debt as a weapon, so to speak.
Really?
Yeah. It would be very harmful to their economy as well.
Oh, okay.
And
I feel better.
Yeah. You know, the scarier people are the credit card companies who own the rest of us, you know.
Sure. The insurance companies.
Yeah.
Pharmaceuticals.
But anyway, back to Afghanistan, that mm-hmm. figure, you know, if Obama decides to give McChrystal the 40,000 troops he wants, that's $40 billion a year added on to what we're already spending, which is about $30 billion a year over there.
This is insane.
So this is really nuts. And it's, you know, it is Quagmire City. This is not the way to go. And I would encourage people to get on the horn and call the White House. And, you know, we need to really light up that switchboard all week
mm-hmm.
and let people know it's easy. It's the area code is 202-456-1111.
Repeat that.
202-456-1111. That's the White House comment line.
Call them and tell them what you think.
And just tell them no escalation in Afghanistan.
You know, it's so funny, too, that this movement that's rose up since the healthcare debate started last summer with they're called teabaggers, but, you know, these people, including a lot of the Congress and Senate, be they right or left wing, because there's Democrats in on this, too. They're saying you're mortgaging our children's future with this plan you want to get. Wait a minute. Every time they vote for the money for the war,
right.
Isn't that doing the same thing?
Yeah, it's, you know, if the Republicans and a lot of the Democrats could ever be held accountable for their hypocrisy, I mean, but you're right. Yeah, you know, the Republicans are screaming, you know, deficit over the health care plan, which
yeah.
is going to cost $100 billion over 10 years. That's that's $10 billion a year. But they are the most avid ones to send the 40,000 troops or the $40 billion a year to Afghanistan.
Well, and I remember the figure of Iraq. Wasn't it $15 billion a month we were spending there
yeah.
during the height of that, of its, you know, big conflict?
We are still spending huge amounts in Iraq. We are still there. Not clear how quickly we're going to get out of there.
Well, they got too many permanent bases built. We can't leave there now.
But that's true.
Camp Anaconda.
Not to mention the world's largest U.S. embassy is in
that
Baghdad.
That too, right, yeah, right. Talking to Paul George, director of Peninsula Peace and Justice, got a big show tomorrow night downtown Palo Alto at the First Presbyterian Church with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! And you got other stuff coming up too, right, Paul?
The major things on the calendar right now are in January, January 21st, Norman Solomon, the syndicated columnist, author, media critic, who's just back from Afghanistan, by the way, and is really fired up. He's going to be coming on January 21st, and the date is significant in that, you know, January 20th was Inauguration Day. So,
oh, it'll be the first year.
So 1 year of Barack Obama as president. We're going to do a little review.
Good idea.
And, yeah, that should be really interesting. And then in February 27th, the great foreign correspondent for the Independent newspaper of London, Robert Fisk, will be coming back to the Bay Area, and he'll be speaking for us on February 27th.
That is amazing. He is incredible. I've seen him here at Stanford, and he's one of the greatest minds of our time.
Yeah, a truly authentic and plain-spoken journalist.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the title of his talk is Lies, Misreporting, and Crises in the Middle East. And you know, his point is going to be how much bad reporting leads to bad situations in these critical areas. So we're looking forward to welcoming Norman Solomon and Robert Fisk.
You're still doing a TV show, too, the first Tuesday of every
first
month?
First Tuesday of every month. We do other voices on local cable television. It's also webcast live, and then you can see it on the web at our website. In fact, the most recent one, which is up on the website now, peaceandjustice.org, it's a really good episode with a Stanford professor, Joel Bainan, professor of Middle East history.
Oh, he was on this show the day before that. Day before he did that. That's right.
Yeah, and we talked about the Goldstone Report, the United Nations investigation into alleged war crimes during the Gaza War, Israel's attack on Gaza over winter 2008-2009, December and January. And this guy, Richard Goldstone, is a South African jurist. He headed up the Yugoslavia war crimes investigation, Kosovo, Rwanda. The guy knows his stuff, and he reported back to the United Nations that indeed both sides, the Israeli army and Hamas, committed war crimes during that. Hamas, by firing these kind of homemade rockets, but they're deadly nevertheless, just kind of indiscriminately firing those into Israel. And a whole list of alleged war crimes on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces, beginning with complete blockade, really, of Gaza and not allowing sufficient supplies in, where the shooting war is over, but the suffering of millions of Palestinians trapped in Gaza continues because just the very, very basics are being allowed into the area by Israel. And during the bombing in December and January, they wiped out water purification plants, sewage plants. They had sewage running in the streets because of it. The ocean is still polluted off Gaza because of that. They bombed hundreds of factories. These are not military targets. And so, you know, that's one of the things that constitutes war crimes. And then I forget the exact figure, something like 1,500 Palestinians were killed. The vast majority of them were civilians, including children.
Did you see the piece on Democracy Now! In the last couple of weeks where Amy Goodman got to interview a Israeli soldier who's actually coming forward now? There's several of them coming forward saying what their instructions were just before they went into Gaza. It was basically shoot to kill.
Yeah, basically
anything and everything.
Yeah, basically they had no instructions.
Yeah, it was a free-for-all.
Yeah, that's Goldstone, in doing his investigation for the United Nations, talked to a lot of these Israeli soldiers who were voluntarily coming forward because he got zero cooperation from the Israeli government. They just refused to recognize the mission. They totally rejected the report when it came out. And the United States has rejected the report. U.S. Congress, a couple of weeks ago, passed a resolution by a huge lopsided margin.
They were going to vote on it the next day after Joel was here, and that was the day that you guys were on your TV show. So they did vote it. I didn't pay attention to it, but they did vote for it?
Yeah. It passed overwhelmingly, as these resolutions often do.
No surprise, though, right?
No, it wasn't surprising. What the small bit of encouragement that came out of it is that something like 32 voted no, and similar number voted present, meaning they weren't voting yes or no. And that's a big step forward to have that many people not vote yes on something like this. One of the upshots of the Gaza war in December and January is that Israel took a big PR hit, basically. Unlike past times, in Europe especially, what happened during that war has been really criticized heavily. And this Goldstone report was part of that.
And can you even call it a war? You know, a war is usually between two armies, right?
Well, Hamas is armed, and they're well-trained and well-disciplined, but, you know, they just don't have the weapons. You know, they don't have tanks and armored personnel carriers and jet fighters and helicopters, so it's pretty lopsided. And especially when Israel controls all the borders and controls what gets in and gets out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the entire Gaza economy now is dependent on smuggling, what can be brought in through tunnels that are dug under the Gaza-Egypt border. And, you know, this is no way for people to live. Israel makes a lot of noise about how they withdrew from Gaza, but the people are essentially still in prison within the boundaries of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Paul George, director of Peninsula Peace and Justice, and I try to have him as a guest every month. I don't hit it on the head every time, but going to have Amy Goodman in Palo Alto tomorrow night, in case you just tuned in, speaking for Peninsula Peace and Justice on our most recent book tour. And Paul, you've hooked up with a group on campus here, too. Why don't you speak about that? Because I think she'll be coming in pretty soon, right?
Yeah, well, much rather have the student talk about the student organization, but there's an active group on campus called Stanford Says No to War. They've been around since the start of the Iraq War. I believe that's why they got organized in the first place. They've done things like march over downtown and join us at our downtown anti-war rallies in Palo Alto.
Mm.
And their major campaign this year is aimed at Condoleezza Rice and being back on campus. And we were just speaking about war crimes, and their position is that Condoleezza Rice is guilty of war crimes herself and should not be in an academic situation. But hopefully we'll have the student representative in here soon, and we'll let her run that down for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to remind people, since we started off on that, talking about the television program, there's, again, Joel Bainan's appearance on Other Voices is available on our website for free streaming. It's an hour-long program, and so I really recommend that. And while you're there, take a look at some other ones. Other videos that are currently online or other voices from the previous month was Lucy Rodriguez, who's an attorney, and she had just gone with a whole group of attorneys and judges to take a look at what's going on in Honduras and the illegal coup down there. So that's a really interesting program. That's online and available right now. And returning to the subject of Afghanistan, if you really want to get a good lay of the land and why escalation in Afghanistan is such a bad idea, you could do worse than check out a video from, I believe it was our September program with Khan Hallinan, who is a foreign policy analyst for a think tank called Foreign Policy in Focus. And he is really good on Afghanistan. And this program, this video that's online at peaceandjustice.org, we really got into all the ins and outs and why this is a quagmire and why it's such a bad idea. I had actually been hoping to be able to quote from a Khan Hallinan article, but we didn't get our computer hook up here. He just recently put out an article that I posted as our pick of the day. We post a pick of the day article.
Can we get it online?
Sure.
Or maybe, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a quick musical break and we can pull it up?
Okay, and maybe switch seats. Yeah, because he's got just a paragraph or two in there that really shows a, you know, lays it out very simply why the escalation won't work and why we have to find another direction, i.e. out of Afghanistan.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and be back with that piece from Con, what's his name?
Hallinan.
Con Hallinan.
Of the famous San Francisco Hallinans. Hey, Bird. Well, here's the article. It's called Why the Afghan Surge Will Fail, written again by Con Hallinan, who's a foreign policy analyst for a think tank called Foreign Policy in Focus. And I thought this was a really good piece because he's got just a short paragraph here that kind of explains why none of this is going to work. And so if I can just read a little bit of this. Before the Obama administration buys into General Stanley McChrystal's escalation strategy, it might spend some time examining the August 12th Battle of Danana, a scruffy little town of 2,000 perched at the entrance to the my Afghan isn't very good at to the entrance to the Nal Zad Valley in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. Danana is a textbook example of why counterinsurgency won't work in that country, as well as a case study in military thinking straight out of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. According to the United States, the purpose of the attack was to seize a strategic town, cut Taliban supply lines, secure the area for the presidential elections. Taking Danana would also, quote, outflank the insurgents, end quote, isolating them in the surrounding mountains and forests. That was the official U.S. line about this, trying to take this town. So Hallinan goes on in his article, what is wrong with this scenario? One, the concept of a strategic town of 2,000 people in a vast country filled with tens of thousands of villages like Danana is bizarre. Two, the Taliban don't have flanks. They are a fluid, irregular force, not an infantry company dug into a set position. Flanking an enemy is what you did to the Wehrmacht in World War II. Three, Taliban supply lines are not highways and rail intersections. They're goat trails. Four, isolate the Taliban in the surrounding mountains and forests. Obviously, no one in the Pentagon has ever read the story of Br'er Rabbit, who taunted his adversary with the famous words, "Please don't throw me in the briar patch, Br'er Fox." Mountains and forests are where the Taliban move freely. The Taliban were also not the slightest bit surprised when the United States showed up. When the Marines helicoptered in at night, all was quiet. At dawn, the Taliban have... At dawn, the Taliban have no night fighting equipment. The insurgents opened up with rockets, mortars, and machine guns. I am pretty sure they know of it in advance, the company commander said, told the Associated Press. So that's kind of a small wrap-up of what the proposed surge is supposed to do. Strategic towns, cut Taliban supply lines, secure for the presidential elections, and somehow outflank a guerrilla army which doesn't have flanks. And again, if I can repeat, we are probably going to hear this decision this week from President Obama when he returns from Asia. Predictions out of Washington are that the announcement could come as early as Thursday, the 19th. And again, I would encourage people to get on the phone to the White House and let them know that you do not support an escalation of the eight-year-old and counting war in Afghanistan. And I'll repeat the number one more time for the White House, 202-456-1111. Do you want to switch seats back?
Yeah, Paul, let's take another little musical break because your guest is here, the Stanford student. And we're going to want to talk to her. And we might even try a new experiment, too, after that.
Oh, stand by for that.
You never know what you're going to hear around here.
Hey, this is Blue Velvet. I just wanted to let people know we got an email from a student here on campus who told us about a docudrama comedy which delves into the less discussed political side of the issue, which of swine flu. And so this filmmaker, Greg Berger, he shot this documentary right in Mexico City, right at the height of the hysteria of swine flu. And he will be showing his film. It'll be free tomorrow, Tuesday evening, in the mural room of Stern Dining Hall from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. So anybody who would like to see this drama comedy film, please go to Stern Dining Hall tomorrow, Tuesday evening from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Those of us who aren't going to be able to make it to Amy Goodman, I'll be there volunteering with Paul George if anybody wants to meet me. Just kidding, or see Paul, or best of all, to see Amy, whom I volunteered for all weekend long at the Green Festival. Anyways, so in this film, one of the main messages Berger tries to get across is that swine flu was not caused by illegal immigrants, like so many American news media sources originally said, but instead, rather ironically, by a U.S. pork production company whose unregulated practices contribute to a number of health and environmental hazards in Veracruz, Mexico, where the first case of this strain of swine flu was recorded. Okay, and also students will be participating, student activists and STAMP will be taking part in guerrilla theater tomorrow and tomorrow, Tuesday, by wearing flu masks on campus, inscribed with the film's screening time and date. So please see this film if you're not going to go to see Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! At the Peace and Justice Center. on Cowper at the church.
First Presbyterian
Church.
Peaceandjustice.org.
And you could look at peaceandjustice.org for more information for that. But if you're going to be on campus and you're stuck and you want to do some activism or you want to see what's going on in the world from a different perspective, please go to Stern's Dining Hall in the Mural Room from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Thank you, Blue Velvet.
Sorry about that. Okay.
That's the producer of this show, Miss Blue Velvet, and we thank her for all her hard work. She's without her, this show wouldn't exist. I'll say that right now. Back with Paul George, and Paul, you've got guests.
Not to mention the fresh out of the oven biscuits that she brought.
How about that?
Yeah, still hot.
You got a producer that brings her own bread.
Yeah.
But right now, Paul, you've contacted one of the students, and we're more than happy to have her on the air here. As a matter of fact, girl, where you been, man? No, we've been doing this social justice work now in a couple of years now, and we've wanted to hook up with students. So, Paul, why don't you go ahead and introduce her?
Well, Stanford Says No to War is a group that we've been working with off and on for many years, and one of their representatives, Sharon Espenshade, is here with us to talk about a new effort this year. Not directly related to the war, but it is related to the war. Shara, welcome to Shedding Light.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Get real close to the mic, Shara.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're fine.
So, first of all, you've got a meeting, organizing meeting, coming up mm-hmm. Wednesday night that you wanted to invite everybody to. Just tell us where and when and what it's all about.
Yeah, so this Wednesday, 2 days, November 18th, I believe is the date, from 6:15 to 7:15 p.m., in room 122 in the first floor of Old Union on Stanford's campus. We're going to be having our first meeting of the year for this coalition that we got together last spring, the Stanford Coalition Against War Crimes. And that's made up of students and community members organizing to push for the investigation of Condoleezza Rice and her prosecution if the facts warrant, which we believe they do, but we have to do an investigation first. And that's what we're calling for. And so we have a lot of ideas on the table. It's a lot of exciting ideas that have been coming up. Among them, a city council resolution calling for her investigation and possibly ASSU, the Associated Student Senate, or the student government body of Stanford. We also want to possibly do a resolution, try to pass a resolution through them. So these are some ideas that have been raised, and we're going to be making plans of action for those. There are several other exciting ones out there, and if you have any other ideas, we would love to hear them. Or yeah, so that's open to anybody and everybody who's concerned about the issue of having an alleged war criminal on our campus and how to react to that.
Shara, how did you become concerned about this?
Well, I've been involved with anti-war activism since the Iraq War started in 2003, and to me, accountability for the war crimes of the Bush administration is a crucial part of the anti-war movement, because these crimes are continuing under the Obama administration, and they will continue unless we can set a precedent for their prosecution. So the use of torture, the like policies of torture of the United States are continuing. The illegal war in Iraq and the illegal war in Afghanistan are continuing. And these, we want to raise all of these issues in talking about Condoleezza Rice and her presence on campus. She was very much involved in the war in Iraq, and as well as torture. Those are the two things we're focusing on because they're so clearly illegal, and they are so disastrous in terms of the human cost. So I think that it's not at all like a lot of people like to say that accountability for war crimes is looking backwards, it's about revenge against the Bush administration. I don't care about that at all. I don't really care what happens to Condoleezza Rice. If she lives in a mansion, that's fine with me. All I want is that this not continue. This is about the future, as a matter of fact. This is about stopping policies of torture and aggressive wars in the future, and that can only happen through our legal system, through prosecution.
What is Condoleezza Rice doing on campus right now? Is she teaching, or research. I recently read an article that she's apparently now the star recruiter for the football team. Mm-hmm. But
what?
That's right.
She's recruiting for the football
team? She's recruiting for the football team, yes.
Wow. Girl gets around.
But what is her official position?
So she's a professor and a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution. She
professor of what?
Professor of political science. Oh, okay. She's, although she's teaching, I believe... her first class that she's taught since she's got back is going to be this winter quarter. She might be teaching one this fall. I'm pretty sure. Like, none of her classes are in the bulletin because we've been looking for them and they're not in the bulletin.
Do you guys want to enroll in them?
Well, if this is so interesting. Apparently, the first class she's teaching is next winter quarter, and it's in the business school, and it's like it's an international relations course, but I think it somehow might be associated with the business school, or maybe that was the class that she's teaching in the fall. But I know that her class in the winter is one that is the first one that we like found out about, and it's a seminar class, and you have to apply to get in, which is very rare in international relations classes.
So maybe they're screening students. Huh?
Yeah, that's our suspicion, is that they're definitely screening students. And you could argue that so many people are going to want to be in that class that they had to do that kind of system. But it's interesting. I would encourage you to look it up online and read the description, because it's very much, it's like they're going to do like a crisis scenario at the end, and how to make like international relations decisions in crisis. And I suspect that it'll be a lot of her kind of defending her actions, because that's always what she brings up, is like, this was a crisis scenario. It was after 9/11. We had to make these kinds of decisions, which I don't believe actually holds. But yeah, so that's going to be her class in the winter quarter. And we considered trying to enroll, but there was some discussion about whether it would be like ethical to, you know, go through the application process, and then should we take the class if we do get in, or I don't know, would we even get in? And some people don't feel like it's ethical to even take the class with her because they don't want to be around her. I don't know. I was very interested in taking the class. I won't be here next quarter, unfortunately, but...
You're leaving?
Yes.
Where are you going to?
I'm going to travel through Central America.
Oh, but then you're coming back?
I'm coming back, yeah.
Okay. Did you guys ever think about this tact here? Before the war, mm-hmm. when Condoleezza begrudgingly really didn't want to be questioned by the 9/11 Commission, mm-hmm. finally went and testified, yeah. and I believe it was Richard Benveniste, got her to admit... that she had the memo that said the U.S. yeah. is going to be attacked and be hit by airplanes into big buildings, and she gave it. She said she delivered the memo and she knew all about it. That pretty much painted a picture for everybody that was listening, that she kind of admitted that they knew, they had been warned about what was going to happen. Yeah. But then it just kind of got dropped there at that point. Did you guys ever think about bringing that up? This doesn't have to do with torture, right. but it kind of paints her in a light of, they basically admitted that they knew about 9/11 before it happened.
Yeah, we've talked about that among ourselves. We're not focusing on it because, okay, so we spent a lot of time doing our research about what exactly Condoleezza Rice was personally responsible for and mm-hmm. where. I mean, we all know well, like, what, you know, what the legacy of the Bush administration is and what all the problems are. But what is it that she specifically did that we can try to, like, what are the avenues open to us in terms of prosecution?
And what did you guys come up with? Well, what makes her a war criminal?
Her personal authorization of torture.
Is it on paper?
Actually, it's interesting. I mean, to an extent, like, she chaired meetings where that was discussed with the National Security Agency. And she gave the CIA the go ahead and use torture, and that's when she made her famous quote, "This uh-huh. is your baby, go do it." Also, interestingly, last spring when we were protesting every appearance she made, she hasn't made a single public speaking appearance since she got back to Stanford last winter. But what she has been doing is going around to different dorms on campus, basically secretly, and the only people who know that she's going to those dorms are the people who live in that dorm, and then she holds a dinner with a select group of like 20 students. And so she was doing that last year, and finally found out about one of them because one of the people in our groups lived in the dorm that she was going to. So we held a counter human rights dinner outside. That was a protest in a sense, but also a very discussion. Like, we really wanted to just get a lot of people and have a discussion, because one of the problems with with this movement on campus is that the student body is not very, it's not a big, like, it's not as controversial of a topic for them as it should be. Then people aren't discussing it on a daily basis. It has been, there has been some articles in the Daily and stuff like that, but in general, people aren't thinking about this on a daily basis when this is reflecting on us as a school. So we really wanted to just create more discussion about it. So we had this human rights dinner outside, and it was at that dinner, after our discussions, that one of the students went inside to Robley and questioned Condoleezza Rice about her approval of the use of waterboarding. And that's when she made the famous statement that, well, firstly, that if the president authorizes it, it is by definition not illegal, which that was, this was on YouTube, this video.
Somebody, that's what Richard somebody Nixon happened, said.
Yes, exactly. It is an Nixonian defense. And she, but she also said during that discussion, or that, I don't know, more like an argument, but what she also said is that she didn't authorize torture. She just passed on the authorization from the president to the CIA, which is her, which there was legal experts were writing about. This video was recorded and put on YouTube, and it went all over the place. It was on Keith Olbermann. It was on all these big places in the mainstream media and got a lot of coverage. And legal experts writing about that said that this might be her downfall. This could be used in court because it was basically admitting to conspiracy. So when she said that she passed on the authorization, that is her admitting to having been involved in that. So yeah, there are a lot of different people out there who have been working really hard on all sorts of different ways to go about trying to call for her prosecution. And there's a lot of options out there. But what we need right now is to really work on getting the Stanford community, which is her home. Like, these are the people who she lives with, and people in Palo Alto and the surrounding area, to make it clear that they want her to be investigated, to really just push on the authorities to call her for her investigation, because we're not even that far yet. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're really trying to focus on right now.
You've been circulating a petition.
Yes.
On this. That campaign still going?
And yes, the petition, about over 1,300 people have signed it already of the Stanford community. We're asking alums, students, faculty, workers, and community members from, you know, the Palo Alto and the area to sign the petition. And you can do that online at antiwar.stanford.edu, which is our website. And that we've been using that too. We've done a few actions surrounding the petition. It was last spring, the April 3rd movement, which was a big anti-war movement at Stanford in the late 60s, 70s. They had an anti-war reunion basically on campus on their 40th anniversary. And they nailed the petition to the door of President Hennessy. And then we also took the petition, we printed out the entire, I don't know how many, 50 pages that it was of all the signatures, and took it to, taped it on the door of the Hoover Institution at a rally that Noam Chomsky spoke at earlier this year. So we've been using it as kind of an awareness tool to try to show the authorities on our campus that students and community members do want investigation, and we are concerned about this issue. We'd like to keep, you know, expanding the numbers of how many people have signed the petition.
How many students on campus, Shara? Is it 23,000?
There's about 7,000 students, I believe.
7,000 on campus?
Yeah.
And you got 1,300 signatures so far?
Yeah, and those are not all students.
Oh, okay.
We have a long way to go. And that's why, but...
Well, she is very well thought of here, and they brought her back on purpose. Yeah. She was the provost here, and now she's recruiting for the football team, so they like her.
Yeah. She's a lock, you know.
Pay attention to it, but they did vote for
it? Yeah. It passed overwhelmingly, as these resolutions often do.
No surprise, though, right?
No, it wasn't surprising. What the small bit of encouragement that came out of it is that something like 32 voted no, and a similar number voted present, meaning they weren't voting yes or no. And that's a big step forward to have that many people not vote yes on something like this. One of the upshots of the Gaza war in December and January is that Israel took a big PR hit, basically. Unlike past times, in Europe especially, what happened during that war has been really criticized heavily, and this Goldstone report was part of that.
And can you even call it a war? You know, a war is usually between two armies, right?
Well, Hamas is armed, and they're well-trained and well-disciplined, but, you know, they just don't have the weapons. You know, they don't have tanks and armored personnel carriers and jet fighters and helicopters, so it's pretty lopsided, and especially when Israel controls all the borders and controls what gets in and gets out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the entire Gaza economy now is dependent on smuggling, what can be brought in through tunnels that are dug under the Gaza-Egypt border. And, you know, this is no way for people to live. Israel makes a lot of noise about how they withdrew from Gaza, but the people are essentially still in prison within the boundaries of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Talking to Paul George, director of Peninsula Peace and Justice, and I try to have him as a guest every month. I don't hit it on the head every time, but going to have Amy Goodman in Palo Alto tomorrow night, in case you just tuned in, speaking for Peninsula Peace and Justice on our most recent book tour. And Paul, you've hooked up with a group on campus here too. Why don't you speak about that? Because I think she'll be coming in pretty soon, right?
Yeah, well, much rather have the student talk about the student organization, but there's an active group on campus called Stanford Says No to War. They've been around since the start of the Iraq War. I believe that's why they got organized in the first place. They've done things like march over downtown and join us at our downtown anti-war rallies in Palo Alto.
Hmm.
And their major campaign this year is aimed at Condoleezza Rice and being back on campus. And we were just speaking about war crimes, and their position is that Condoleezza Rice is guilty of war crimes herself and should not be in an academic situation. But hopefully we'll have the student representative in here soon, and we'll let her run that down for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to remind people, since we started off on that, talking about the television program, there's again, Joel Bainin's appearance on Other Voices is available on our website for free streaming. It's an hour-long program, and so I really recommend that. And while you're there, take a look at some other ones. Other videos that are currently online are Other Voices from the previous month was Lucy Rodriguez, who's an attorney, and she had just gone with a whole group of attorneys and judges to take a look at what's going on in Honduras and the illegal coup down there. So that's a really interesting program. That's online and available right now. Returning to the subject of Afghanistan, if you really want to get a good lay of the land and why escalation in Afghanistan is such a bad idea, you could do worse than check out a video from, I believe it was our September program with Khan Hallinan, who is a foreign policy analyst for a think tank called Foreign Policy in Focus. And he is really good on Afghanistan. And this program, this video that's online at peaceandjustice.org, we really got into all the ins and outs and why this is a quagmire and why it's such a bad idea. I had actually been hoping to be able to quote from a Khan Hallinan article, but we didn't get our computer hook up here. He just recently put out an article that I posted as our pick of the day. We post a pick of the day article.
Can we get it online?
Sure.
Or maybe, why don't we do this? Why don't we take a quick musical break and we can pull it up?
Okay, and maybe switch seats. Yeah, because he's got just a paragraph or two in there that really shows lays it out very simply why the escalation won't work and why we have to find another direction, i.e. out of Afghanistan.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and be back with that piece from Khan, what's his name?
Hallinan.
Khan Hallinan.
Of the famous San Francisco Hallinans. Okay, Bird. Well, here's the article. It's called Why the Afghan Surge Will Fail, written again by Khan Hallinan, who's a foreign policy analyst for a think tank called Foreign Policy in Focus. And I thought this was a really good piece because he's got just a short paragraph here that kind of explains why none of this is going to work. And so if I can just read a little bit of this. Before the Obama administration buys into General Stanley McChrystal's escalation strategy, it might spend some time examining the August 12th Battle of Dhanana, a scruffy little town of 2,000 perched at the entrance to the my Afghan isn't very good at to the entrance to the Nal Zad Valley in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. Dhanana is a textbook example of why counterinsurgency won't work in that country, as well as a case study in military thinking straight out of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. According to the United States, the purpose of the attack was to seize a strategic town, cut Taliban supply lines, secure the area for the presidential elections. Taking Dhanana would also, quote, outflank the insurgents, end quote, isolating them in the surrounding mountains and forests. That was the official U.S. line about this, trying to take this town. So Hallinan goes on in his article, what is wrong with this scenario? One, the concept of a strategic town of 2,000 people in a vast country filled with tens of thousands of villages like Dhanana is bizarre. Two, the Taliban don't have flanks. They are a fluid, irregular force, not an infantry company dug into a set position. Flanking an enemy is what you did to the Wehrmacht in World War II. Three, Taliban supply lines are not highways and rail intersections. They're goat trails. Four, isolate the Taliban in the surrounding mountains and forests. Obviously, no one in the Pentagon has ever read the story of Br'er Rabbit, who taunted his adversary with the famous words, "Please don't throw me in the briar patch, Br'er Fox." Mountains and forests are where the Taliban move freely. The Taliban were also not the slightest bit surprised when the United States showed up. When the Marines helicoptered in at night, all was quiet. At dawn, the Taliban have no night fighting equipment. The insurgents opened up with rockets, mortars, and machine guns. I am pretty sure they know of it in advance, the company commander said, told the Associated Press. So that's kind of a small wrap-up of what the proposed surge is supposed to do. Strategic towns, cut Taliban supply lines, secure for the presidential elections, and somehow outflank a guerrilla army which doesn't have flanks. And again, if I can repeat, we are probably going to hear this decision this week from President Obama when he returns from Asia. Predictions out of Washington are that the announcement could come as early as Thursday, the 19th. And again, I would encourage people to get on the phone to the White House and let them know that you do not support an escalation of the eight-year-old and counting war in Afghanistan. And I'll repeat the number one more time for the White House, 202-456-1111. Do you want to switch seats back?
Yeah, Paul, let's take another little musical break because your guest is here, the Stanford student. And we're gonna want to talk to her. And we might even try a new experiment, too, after that.
Oh, stand by for that.
You never know what you're going to hear around here.
Do, 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 do
Okay, this is Blue Velvet. I just wanted to let people know we got an email from a student here on campus who told us about a docudrama comedy which delves into the less discussed political side of the issue, which of swine flu. And so this filmmaker, Greg Berger, he shot this documentary right in Mexico City, right at the height of the hysteria of swine flu. And he will be showing his film. It'll be free tomorrow, Tuesday evening, in the mural room of Stern Dining Hall from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. So anybody who would like to see this drama comedy film, please go to Stern Dining Hall tomorrow, Tuesday evening, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Those of us who aren't going to be able to make it to Amy Goodman, I'll be there volunteering with Paul George if anybody wants to meet me. Just kidding, or see Paul, or best of all, to see Amy, whom I volunteered for all weekend long at the Green Festival. Anyways, so in this film, one of the main messages Berger tries to get across is that swine flu was not caused by illegal immigrants, like so many American news media sources originally said, but instead, rather ironically, by a U.S. pork production company whose unregulated practices contribute to a number of health and environmental hazards in Veracruz, Mexico, where the first case of this strain of swine flu was recorded. Okay, and also students will be participating, student activists and STAMP will be taking part in guerrilla theater tomorrow and tomorrow, Tuesday, by wearing flu masks on campus, inscribed with the film's screening time and date. So please see this film. If you're not going to go Democracy, to see Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! At the Peace and Justice Center on Cowper at the church.
First Presbyterian
Church.
Peaceandjustice.org.
And you could look at peaceandjustice.org for more information for that. But if you're going to be on campus and you're stuck and you want to do some activism, or you want to see what's going on in the world from a different perspective, please go to Stern's Dining Hall in the mural room from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Thank you, Blue Velvet.
Sorry about that. Okay.
That's the producer of this show, Miss Blue Velvet, and we thank her for all her hard work. She's without her, this show wouldn't exist. I'll say that right now. Back with Paul George, and Paul, you've got guests.
Not to mention the fresh out of the oven biscuits that
How
she
about
brought.
That,
yeah,
huh?
Still hot.
You got a producer that brings her own bread.
Yeah.
But right now, Paul, you've contacted one of the students, and we're more than happy to have her on the air here. As a matter of fact, girl, where you been, man? No, we've been doing this social justice work now a couple of years now, and we've wanted to hook up with students. So, Paul, why don't you go ahead and introduce her?
Well, Stanford Says No to War is a group that we've been working with off and on for many years, and one of their representatives, Sharon Espenshade, is here with us to talk about a new effort this year. Not directly related to the war, but it is related to the war. Shara, welcome to Shedding Light.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Get real close to the mic, Shara.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you're fine.
So, first of all, you've got a meeting, organizing meeting, coming up mm-hmm. Wednesday night that you wanted to invite everybody to. Just tell us where and when and what it's all about.
Yeah, so this Wednesday, 2 days, November 18th, I believe is the date, from 6:15 to 7:15 p.m., in room 122 in the first floor of Old Union on Stanford's campus. We're going to be having our first meeting of the year for this coalition that we got together last spring, the Stanford Coalition Against War Crimes. And that's made up of students and community members organizing to push for the investigation of Condoleezza Rice and her prosecution if the facts warrant, which we believe they do, but we have to do an investigation first. And that's what we're calling for. And so we have a lot of ideas on the table. It's a lot of exciting ideas that have been coming up, among them a city council resolution calling for her investigation, and possibly a ASSU, the Associated Student Senate, or the student government body of Stanford. We also want to possibly do a resolution, try to pass a resolution through them. So these are some ideas that have been raised, and we're going to be making plans of action for those. There are several other exciting ones out there, and if you have any other ideas, we would love to hear them, or Yeah, so that's open to anybody and everybody who's concerned about the issue of having an alleged war criminal on our campus and how to react to that.
Shara, how did you become concerned about this?
Well, I've been involved with anti-war activism since the Iraq War started in 2003, and to me, accountability for the war crimes of the Bush administration is a crucial part of the anti-war movement, because these crimes are continuing under the Obama administration, and they will continue unless we can set a precedent for their prosecution. So the use of torture, the like policies of torture of the United States are continuing. The illegal war in Iraq and the illegal war in Afghanistan are continuing. And these, we want to raise all of these issues in talking about Condoleezza Rice and her presence on campus. She was very much involved in the war in Iraq, and as well as torture. Those are the two things we're focusing on because they're so clearly illegal, and they are so disastrous in terms of the human cost. So I think that it's not at all like a lot of people like to say that accountability for war crimes is looking backwards, it's about revenge against the Bush administration. I don't care about that at all. I don't really care what happens to Condoleezza Rice. If she lives in a mansion, that's fine with me. All I want is that this not continue. This is about the future, as a matter of fact. This is about stopping policies of torture and aggressive wars in the future, and that can only happen through our legal system, through prosecution.
What is Condoleezza Rice doing on campus right now? Is she teaching or research? I recently read an article that she's apparently now the star recruiter for the football team. Mm-hmm. But
what?
That's right.
She's recruiting for the football
team? She's recruiting for the football team, yes.
Wow. Girl gets around.
But what is her official position?
So she's a professor and a Hoover Fellow at the Hoover Institution. She
professor
is
of what?
Professor of political science. Oh, okay. She's, although she's teaching, I believe, her first class that she's taught since she's got back is going to be this winter quarter. She might be teaching one this fall. I'm pretty sure. Like, none of her classes are in the bulletin because we've been looking for them and they're not in the bulletin.
Do you guys want to enroll in them?
Well, if this is so interesting. Apparently, the first class she's teaching is next winter quarter, and it's in the business school, and it's like, or no, it's an international relations course, but I think it somehow might be associated with the business school, or maybe that was the class that she's teaching in the fall. But I know that her class in the winter is one that is the first one that we like found out about, and it's a seminar class, and you have to apply to get in, which is very rare in international relations classes.
So maybe they're screening students. Huh?
Yeah, that's our suspicion, is that they're definitely screening students. And you could argue that so many people are going to want to be in that class that they had to do that kind of system. But it's interesting. I would encourage you to look it up online and read the description, because it's very much, it's like they're going to do like a crisis scenario at the end, and how to make like international relations decisions in crisis. And I suspect that it'll be a lot of her kind of defending her actions, because that's always what she brings up, is like, this was a crisis scenario. It was after 9/11. We had to make these kinds of decisions, which I don't believe actually holds. But yeah, so that's going to be her class in the winter quarter. And we considered trying to enroll, but there was some discussion about whether it would be like ethical to, you know, go through the application process, and then should we take the class if we do get in, or I don't know, would we even get in? And some people don't feel like it's ethical to even take the class with her because they don't want to be around her. I don't know. I was very interested in taking the class. I won't be here next quarter, unfortunately, but
you're leaving?
Yes.
Where are you going to?
I'm gonna travel through Central America.
Oh, but then you're coming back?
I'm coming back, yeah.
Okay. No, did you guys ever think about this tact here before the war, mm-hmm. when Condoleezza begrudgingly really didn't want to be questioned by the 9/11 commission, mm-hmm. finally went and testified, yeah. and I believe it was Richard Benveniste got her to admit that she had the memo that said the U.S. is going to be attacked and be hit by airplanes in the big buildings, and she gave it. She said she delivered the memo and she knew all about it. That pretty much painted a picture for everybody that was listening that she kind of admitted that they knew, they had been warned about what was going to happen. Yeah. But then it just kind of got dropped there at that point. Did you guys ever think about bringing that up? This doesn't have to do with torture, right. But it kind of paints her in a light of, they basically admitted that they knew about 9/11 before it happened.
Yeah, we've talked about that among ourselves. We're not focusing on it because, okay, so we spent a lot of time doing our research about what exactly Condoleezza Rice was personally responsible for and mm-hmm. where, I mean, we all know well, like, what, you know, what the legacy of the Bush administration is and what all the problems are, but what is it that she specifically did that we can try to, like, what are the avenues open to us in terms of prosecution?
And what did you guys come up with? Well, what makes her a war criminal?
Her personal authorization of torture.
Is it on paper?
Actually, it's interesting. I mean, to an extent, like, she chaired meetings where that was discussed with the National Security Agency. And she gave the CIA the go-ahead to go ahead and use torture, and that's when she made her famous quote, "This is your baby, go do it." Also, interestingly, last spring when we were protesting every appearance she made, she hasn't made a single public speaking appearance since she got back to Stanford last winter. But what she has been doing is going around to different dorms on campus, basically secretly, and the only people who know that she's going to those dorms are the people who live in that dorm, and then she holds a dinner with a select group of like 20 students. And so she was doing that last year and finally found out about one of them because one of the people in our groups lived in the dorm that she was going to. So we held a counter human rights dinner outside. That was a protest in a sense, but also a very discussion. Like, we really wanted to just get a lot of people and have a discussion because one of the problems with this movement on campus is that the student body is not very, it's not a big, like, it's not as controversial of a topic for them as it should be. Then people aren't discussing it on a daily basis. There has been some articles in the Daily and stuff like that, but in general, people aren't thinking about this on a daily basis when this is reflecting on us as a school. So we really wanted to just create more discussion about it. So we had this human rights dinner outside, and it was at that dinner, after our discussions, that one of the students went inside to Robley and questioned Condoleezza Rice about her approval of the use of waterboarding. And that's when she made the famous statement that, well, firstly, that if the president authorizes it, it is by definition not illegal, which this was on YouTube, this video.
That's what Richard Nixon said.
Yes, exactly. It is an Nixonian defense. And she also said during that discussion, I don't know, more like an argument, but what she also said is that she didn't authorize torture. She just passed on the authorization from the president to the CIA, which there was a legal experts were writing about. This video was recorded and put on YouTube, and it went all over the place. It was on Keith Olbermann. Mm-hmm. It was on all these big places in the mainstream media and got a lot of coverage. And legal experts writing about that said that this might be her downfall. This could be used in court because it was basically admitting to conspiracy. Mm. So when she said that she passed on the authorization, that is her admitting to having been involved in that. So yeah, there are a lot of different people out there who have been working really hard on all sorts of different ways to go about trying to call for her prosecution. And there's a lot of options out there, but what we need right now is to really work on getting the Stanford community, which is her home. Like, these are the people who she lives with and people in Palo Alto and the surrounding area, to make it clear that they want her to be investigated, to really just push on the authorities to call her for her investigation, because we're not even that far yet. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're really trying to focus on right now.
You've been circulating a petition on this. That campaign still going?
And yes, the petition, about over 1,300 people have signed it already of the Stanford community. We're asking alums, students, faculty, workers, and community members from, you know, the Palo Alto and the area to sign the petition. And you can do that online at antiwar.stanford.edu, which is our website. And that we've been using that too. We've done a few actions surrounding the petition. It was last spring, the April 3rd movement, which was a big anti-war movement at Stanford in the late 60s, 70s. They had an anti-war reunion basically on campus on their 40th anniversary. And they nailed the petition to the door of President Hennessy. And then we also took the petition, we printed out the entire, I don't know how many, 50 pages that it was of all the signatures, and took it to, taped it on the door of the Hoover Institution at a rally that Noam Chomsky spoke at earlier this year. So we've been using it as kind of an awareness tool to try to show the authorities on our campus that students and community members do want investigation, and we are concerned about this issue. We'd like to keep, you know, expanding the numbers of how many people have signed the petition.
How many students on campus, Shara? Is it 23,000?
There's about 7,000 students, I believe.
7,000 on campus?
Yeah.
And you got 1,300 signatures so far.
Yeah, and those are not all students.
Oh, okay.
We have a long way to go. And that's why, but...
Well, she is very well thought of here, and they brought her back on purpose. Yeah. She was the provost here, and now she's recruiting for the football team, so they like her.
Yeah. She's a lock, you know, that's
she really is. And here's the deal. Stanford just won 55 to whatever over one of the heaviest teams in the universe. So, I mean, you know, a lot. Locked in there like that. No, I'm
wondering what kind of reaction, if any, you've gotten from the administration at this point. Has there been any official reaction?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, we haven't officially approached them and asked them to give us an official answer, because we decided that we don't need, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about this, whether to like push for her to be fired or Stanford University to take action. And we decided that we don't want to call for that. We don't want to raise this issue of trying to take away a professor's tenureship has been used against leftist professors in the past, and we don't necessarily want to go that route, because the whole issue here is that this is not about her academic behavior or anything like that. It's about her crimes, which are very concrete and far-reaching, and so we decided that we wanted to push for her investigation by the state. However, we have been questioning like university officials when they have public meetings. So once last spring, President Hennessy spoke in my dorm and we questioned him about Condoleezza Rice, and his response was basically, you know, I'm not comfortable with everything she did, but I don't think we have a place to do anything about this. And we asked him to please sign the petition, and he said, I don't sign petitions. So he really doesn't want to take a firm stance on this at all. He just said he really didn't defend her necessarily. But he refused to say anything against her. And what he did keep repeating, and this was the frustrating part for me, was that, you know, you don't understand what she was going through. It was right after 9/11. It was a crisis situation. You don't understand what she was going through. So that was his response, basically.
Echoing her excuse.
So that was the part that really did, like, make me angry, because that's not an acceptable excuse.
Do you have any students in your movement from the law school?
We have gotten some... There have been a few people involved from the law school in these coalition meetings.
You know, another tact you could take is have your own tribunal.
Yeah.
Set up your own court and do that.
We absolutely have.
You might not get any recourse the other way, but you could set a record, you know, like you're doing with your petition.
Exactly. Put it on the public record.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have discussed that a lot, actually. That came up a lot last year. Yeah, hopefully people will bring that up again this Wednesday. Our movement... I mean,
about that again. When is the meeting again, and where?
The movement is this. The meeting is this Wednesday from 6:15 to 7:15 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
In room 122 on the first floor of Old Union on Stanford's campus. And we'd really like as many people who are concerned about this issue as possible to come, because that's the issue. We have a lot of great ideas, and we don't have enough people to be able to implement them all. So we're doing our best, but we're small, and that's what we're trying to work on right now, is really spread awareness and get more people to be conscious about this issue and to be moved to actually act.
You know who might let you on her show? Because she might just bite on this story, is Amy Goodman. Now, she's going to be in Palo Alto tomorrow night with Paul George.
I'm going to go see her.
Are you? You should go talk to her about this.
I have actually talked to her about this. When she was here last year, we went up afterwards and let her know that we were acting on this Condoleezza Rice issue, and we gave her a copy of our letter to the Stanford community that we had written.
She get back to you at all or anything?
Well, she said, you know, if you want to do a story, send it to our news people. We felt that we would wait until we had a really big story to announce. So when we have a big action that we really do want coverage of. Democracy
Now is the best place for it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I would love to see that.
Shedding
that.
Light is not a bad place to shed some light on this. You know, I wanted to ask, you've obviously put a lot of thought and discussion into this, and you really seem to be focusing on Rice's role in torture, waterboarding, extraordinary rendition. And one of the things that I always think about is that the war itself, the invasion of Iraq itself, was illegal. It was aggressive war. And, you know, the what came out of the Nuremberg trials, the Chief Justice after World War II said that aggressive war is the greatest war crime of all, because from that flows all other war crimes.
The supreme war crime.
Yeah. Do you focus on that at all? The fact that she played a critical role in selling this illegal war to the American people.
Absolutely.
I mean, the mushroom cloud image is is one that stays
was her
with
quote.
Us.
Yes. Yeah. We would, like, personally, this has been such a conflict for me, because what I really want to focus on in my activism is ending the wars that are ongoing right now.
Mm-hmm.
To me, torture is extremely important to be talking about, but to me, the war is the most pressing issue. This is something that over a million innocent people have been killed already in Iraq. And this, to me, that's the biggest thing right now. And torture is important. To me, the reason that torture is so important is because of the way in which it helps the war. It helps, it's a crucial part to me of our war policies and our policies of imperialism and terrorism. That is why torture has become a policy of the United States.
So it's a dangerous precedent too.
Yes. Yeah. There are lots of different ways to argue against torture. The reason that we have focused a little bit more on torture than the war with regards to Condoleezza Rice is because, she personally, you know, she chaired the meetings as National Security Advisor, and gave the, like, personally was the one to authorize the use of torture. So it's easier to, like, draw to point out where exactly she violated the law specifically. Even though we know that as the chief advisor to President Bush, she had played a major role in executing the Iraq War as well, and in all of the many, many, like, and very well documented lies that she made to the public throughout the run up to the Iraq War. So those perhaps are able to be prosecuted, but it seems to be more clear cut this on torture in terms of, like, as a method to investigate and prosecute her. But to me, it's just the war in Iraq is absolutely that is what is so so terrible about the Bush administration, and so that is almost more important, and definitely probably more important for sure for me. So we are trying to talk about that more and more and more and bring that up more. It's just that we talk about torture because that's the way that we can go about prosecuting her.
Yeah, especially the YouTube video that you mentioned,
exactly,
where you've got her
exactly
right there.
Right, right.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here, but let's just remind people, Stanford Coalition Against War Crimes, is that right?
Yes.
And first organizing meeting is this Wednesday evening, starting at 6:15 p.m. in room 122 of the Old Union. You got
exactly
that right?
Exactly, yeah.
And more information at antiwar.stanford.edu.
Yes.
Okay. Let's switch gears a lot here and come around to campus, because you're involved with another group, the Stanford Labor Action Coalition,
exactly,
is that correct?
Exactly, yes.
And I've been seeing some emails coming out about a contractor on campus called Colony Landscape and what you're calling worker abuse. Tell us about that. What's going on campus with the workers?
Yeah, so Colony Landscaping is one of the subcontractors on campus. One of the, like, sources of a lot of the labor rights abuses that happen on Stanford's campus stem from the fact that we subcontract a lot of the labor. So Colony Landscaping does, like, construction and maintenance work on campus. And on October 9th, well, I guess it goes back further than that. So to just give you a sense of some of the abuses that have been going on, basically, Colony has not been paying a living wage to its workers. The living wage is $11.70, and they've been paying $9 an hour to their workers. They haven't been given adequate health care, their workers. The workers aren't being given paid vacations or sick leaves, sick days, allowed to have sick days. They This is crazy. They haven't been allowed to use protective gear when they're using poisonous gases or poisonous chemicals to like treat the grass and stuff like that. First of all, these poisonous things should not be used. They're unhealthy for the people who live around them, the students, and it's really unhealthy for the workers to be using them. And they're not allowed to use protective gear while administering that poisonous stuff because, quote unquote, it would scare the students to see them using this protective gear. So that's a really that abuse is just so symbolic of the
that's a double abuse because yeah. They're admitting that it's a danger to the students who are living in the dorms where they're spraying. And mm-hmm. as you say, they're covering up with the poisons they're spraying yeah. around campus.
Does the administration yeah. know about this?
And there's another. So the other. Well, I'll get to that in a second. They've been intimidating the workers a lot against organizing a union. A lot of the workers have been trying to organize a union. And so basically, the SEIU 1877 stepped in recently and got Colony. So Colony. For Colony to not pay a living wage is completely in violation of the Stanford living wage policy. So it's absolutely like illegal by Stanford rules. And the union stepped
Stanford
in.
Has guidelines for
Stanford has
these
a living wage
contractors,
policy.
Right?
Yes, they
and,
do.
And a living wage is one of the guidelines
yes.
in Stanford's own policy.
Yes, exactly. And so the union stepped in and got this Colony to pay the workers a living wage. Some of these, I don't remember the exact number, but a certain number of workers to pay them a living wage and to give them back pay for all of the past years that they haven't been paid the full $11.70 an hour.
Really?
Yes. So that happened.
Mad about that.
But then on October 9th, three of those same workers who the union had stepped in on their behalf were fired. And it seems very much that we're very concerned that this was an act of retaliation against the union. And we have very good reason to believe this because supervisors have been saying things to the workers like, you know, if you sign a card, you will be fired. Or if you try to unionize, you will be fired. So they have been making threats like this.
Were these three workers that were fired, were they active in the union efforts?
The union had stepped in on their behalf so that seems to be the connection. And yes, they were active with trying to form a union. In terms of whether the administration is aware of this, we just met with Sam Steinhardt. He is the new director of procurement or head of procurement on Stanford's campus. We just met with him last Thursday for the first time this year. His like predecessor was just fired recently for I think it for things that had to do with Colony actually, but we're not clear exactly. So we met with him on Thursday and we told him these concerns that the workers had been coming to us and telling us we have a very close relationship with the workers on campus and they had come to our meetings and told us all of the abuses that I was listening to you. And, you know, it's not just a few isolated cases that were corrected. This is an ongoing, these are not just mistakes. It seems to be this is how Colony treats its workers. So, yeah, so we went to Sam Steinhardt and we told him about these concerns. And right now, Colony's contract is actually about to be, it's about to expire. And Stanford has three choices. It can directly hire those workers. It can hire another contractor or it can go back with Colony. So we told him that whatever you do, you know, we're going to be demanding that that no worker lose their job, that the same workers be hired to do this work and that their rights to unionize be respected and that all these other stop and be corrected. So we asked for him to give us to tell us specifically what measures Stanford is going to take to make sure that these abuses stop. And he seemed to be very he seemed to be
not too receptive.
He listened to what we had to say and we appreciated that. He seems to be uncertain of how much control he has over these issues. That's what he kept repeating, is that I am head
over
of
his head.
Over, yeah, he said, we can't control every contract that happens on Stanford's campus. This is confusing to us because he is head of procurement and we're just not clear on what exactly the role of head of procurement is, if not to enforce Stanford's own living wage policy and other labor rights policies. So this is, we've begun the discussion with Stanford and we've begun the discussion with Colony. We've had several actions in the past few weeks. On November 6th, we, about 40 of us, workers and students, went to Colony's headquarters in El Viso and passed on this message, basically told them about these abuses, these concerns, and we've told them at their headquarters, and
how did they react?
Well, they were extremely, extremely rude. We walked into their headquarters, are basically like a garage where they were working on a vehicle or something. I walked in and said, "Hi, this is who we are. We would like to talk to you. We'd like to make send a message to your manager about some concerns we have." And then we started telling them, and they turned up the radio so loud to drown us out. And this was like very disturbing to us. So we said, "Will you please listen to us?" And there was about four of these guys, and the other one said, "Okay." The ones who had not turned up the radio said, "Okay, we'll go outside and we'll listen to you." Okay. And then they came outside and they listened to us, but they were very rude, just the way that they acted towards us. So that was a little bit discouraging, but you know, we've been sending a lot of emails as well to Colony. We've been communicating in lots of different ways, and we've been trying to do it very politely, but firmly. And so that's what we had another action this Friday, about trying to make clear to Stanford that, you know, because the contract is about to expire, trying to make clear to them that we want a fair contractor or Stanford to directly hire, which would be Slack. Stanford Labor Action Coalition would prefer that, because then Stanford cannot point fingers, and Stanford will, it would be a lot easier for Stanford to just follow the rules. I mean, the rules are good. They're in place. Like, that was a long struggle that Slack historically has done a lot to try to achieve this living wage policy. They fasted, the students fasted for a long time. There was tons of protests and direct actions to achieve that living wage policy. And then for the last 2 years, we've just been begging them to enforce it, and having actions and discussions with them to enforce it. And so that's what we're calling for now.
We're about out of time.
We're almost out of time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Shara Esbenshade, activist on campus here with a couple of organizations. And just another reminder, the Stanford Coalition Against War Crimes, a kickoff organizing meeting this Wednesday, the 18th, starting at 6:15 p.m., room 122 in the Old Union. Come with your ideas of what can be done about having a war criminal on campus. Thanks, Shara.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Paul, thank you.
My